Hi there, my name's Jeremy Thomas, and I am the host of Shed Talks. Shed Talks hopes to be an entertaining, informative podcast that looks at well-being and mental health. And I hope you're going to like it. Welcome to Shed Talks, episode 5. This is going to be a bumper extended edition, and the reason for that is our very special guest, Karen Cowan. Karen, as you may or may not know, is our resident psychologist, but outside of this, she's an extremely successful psychologist specializing in trauma in children. And if I had to award her a degree, it would be a first-class honours degree in survival. When asked what she believed in the most, she said, "I'm obsessed with honesty, maybe to an extreme." Well, that's going to be very handy for us. And I would say that if I had heard of anybody's story like hers, if anybody was going to make a film of someone's life, they would make it of Karen's life. Ladies and gentlemen, fasten your seatbelts. Thank you very much. Welcome, Karen. So normally we don't have people on who I know, but we all met in the middle of the 1980s. And I remember meeting you and Paul, your husband, and thinking how groovy and how glamorous and how extraordinary you were.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, we had very good fun in the 80s, I must admit, down here in the countryside. And it was a brilliant meeting you. If I remember rightly, you gatecrashed one of our parties, which was a Dress to Kill party. And we were friends ever since. And you were very good friends with my husband, Paul,
yes,
as well.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. Well, a tiny bit of that before we get cracking. You got married to Paul in 1978, and you are on record many times saying he was your saviour and a really wonderful person.
Yes, he was. I know people do say this sort of thing about their partners, but he truly was probably the best person I've ever met in my life, in terms of total honesty and straightforwardness. What you say is what you get, and personal strength. He had a bit of an unfortunate flaw in that he had a very bad temper. Mm. But otherwise, he was a truly wonderful man.
A top-rocking person.
Yeah, loved by everyone, yes.
Well, oddly, you basically, I know, had a slightly strange, tricky time up and down, I suppose, before you met Paul, and I think you met him in 1976. Point had absolutely no money at all and worked in a box factory in Canterbury. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. I lived with my boyfriend at the time, who in fact I nearly married, who was in a band, and we rented a house, but we actually couldn't pay the rent in the end, in Canterbury, and I worked in the box factory while they tried to become famous.
Right. Oh, okay. But you came to London then and had a few laughs and met Paul.
Yeah, I came to London and had all sorts of escapades. And then in 1976 was really lucky enough to meet Paul.
Yes, yes. Well, what I always like about Paul is that, you know, most people are what they do. You know, they're a stockbroker or whatever. But Paul was somebody who you could like enormously without knowing that he was a very groovy film producer and somebody who really got involved. I mean, the sort of films he did, Dance with a Stranger, Backbeat, The Craze, The Crying Game, I mean, were all a particular sort of film. But he was great. What was that like? I mean, we're going to talk much more about him later, but What was that like? Sort of, it must be quite great to be involved in all that stuff.
I just remember things like going to a restaurant with a film director and thinking, my gosh, this is all so glamorous.
Yes.
And I loved all that glamour. I mean, the best fun in my life has been going to Cannes Film Festival. So that was really, really fun being able to be part of that. But he was also a really great guy. And one of the things about him that was so nice was that it was very easy to have friends with him, because I'm probably quite loud. And I always used to think that people would think, oh, well, she was a bit loud, but he was nice. So, you know, there was an added bonus of he was always liked, you know, whether people knew he was a film producer or not.
Yeah, he was a very likable person. Absolutely. Well, we'll come back to that. So, I mean, you know, the point of this podcast is to have interesting conversations with people about their own mental health, who've experienced lots of challenges. And it strikes me that we've sort of got a double whammy with you, that you have experienced an extraordinary set of circumstances going back. So perhaps, you know, we're in the TARDIS, we're going back in time, and here we are. You were born in the very early stages of being brought up in Cheshire, in an amazing house, and your parents were very, very glamorous people. Tell us more.
I think they were glamorous because, well, A, they were physically incredibly beautiful, both of them. Sort of, I used to always think, a bit too good looking for their own good. And B, they were glamorous because what other people thought didn't matter, which I think is perhaps one of the cornerstones of glamour in a weird sort of way. And also, they were lucky enough to have inherited a huge amount of money.
Yes.
So that made it a little bit more easy to be glamorous. They'd gone through a sort of tough time because they were the black sheeps of their family for reasons that you'll see later on. But after proving that they could be, as it were, normal and running a chicken farm, they were given this estate in Cheshire.
So your father, Desmond, came from a very grand Irish aristocratic family, and your mum came from a very interesting family, and the two of them together were quite something. And as you say, wealth is wealth. It makes, it can make all the difference in a good way and all the difference in a bad way.
Yes, I think perhaps in a bad way, and in this case, in some ways. But I remember being very aware that they were very glamorous, a lot because of their looks, and also because my father was very sort of powerful and physically fit. And I remember things like going to Harrods and kind of actually being aware that, you know, that all the shop assistants wanted to be near my dad, and staying at the Hyde Park Hotel, which is now the Mandarin Oriental. And I can remember actually the feeling of being, having glamorous parents.
Yes, yes.
I don't know whether my sister can. I think perhaps she missed out on that because she's about 4 or 5 years younger than me.
Yes, yeah. But, I mean, your father had a great interest, and okay, it was the 60s, but had a great interest in psychedelic drugs, and in particular LSD, and then sort of moved on to other things from there. Do you think that was because he was bored or curious or both?
Well, nobody ever really knew what it was. I mean, he was always incredibly wild, and I know that he was, for example, known as Black O'Brien in London because he used to get into so many fights, and all the Deb's parents didn't want him to go to the Deb parties because he would cause fights and all sorts of things. And he was in prison a few times. I don't know always why. I think he was once in prison in the army. I wondered if you know, he got into drugs there, or whether it was just because it was the 60s. And I wonder, some people used to say that it was a bit fatal that he inherited all the land and everything. But then he used to work incredibly hard on the land. But maybe he thought there wasn't any point in anything. I don't know. He was kind of brought up not to do anything, if you see what I mean. But
yes,
but yeah. then he was very, very energetic and speedy. So maybe it wasn't enough. He was always planting trees and things like that. Maybe it wasn't enough. I don't know. Or maybe it was just serendipity, the 60s and the friends that they hung out with when they were in London. They were very quiet in the country, but when they went to London, it was a different matter.
It all went kicked off.
Yeah.
And he certainly became a heroin addict. That was true, wasn't it?
Yeah, he did become a heroin addict. And again, it's very difficult to know why. I have a friend who's a heroin addict, and he says, you know, that he became a heroin addict just from sort of hanging out with the wrong friends. And so I've never really known why my dad became such a heavy duty addict. I think it was maybe about hanging out in London, you know, and the psychedelic club he set up. There was an article in London Life about him saying, and in I think the Daily Express saying, this is Mr. LSD, because he was one of the first people to, well, they said he was the first person to bring LSD into this country. And they were all into sort of tripping and the ultimate psychedelic experience with Timothy Leary and so on. And whether that sort of just led to heroin, I don't know.
Yeah. But what effect did it have on you?
I think it had an enormous effect, really. But the thing is, I've got that classic thing of blocking out a lot about childhood. I think when my parents were in the country, they were very isolated. They didn't have lots of friends. They normally just had one person staying with them, who was often an out-of-work actor or someone. But I remember Dad would be pretty mad, and I think he used to sort of take methadone and pace about and go mad and say, I am the one. And I remember we used to try and hide his heroin. I remember the amazing thing about heroin, which I suppose is a bit like alcoholics, is that they can find it wherever you've hidden it. Because I remember we went up to Port Mary on holiday, and he had a huge box of vials of heroin, and we hid it. And he found it pretty well straight away, and other times that we tried to hide it. But the strange thing is, Jeremy, I can't remember much about it. I can remember it just wasn't good.
No. Well, I mean, we haven't spoken about your mother yet. And I think, you know, that is a huge thing in your life. I mean, it is most people's, but in this particular case, her life was tragic in many ways. I mean, fantastic in a few ways, but ultimately tragic. And again, you know, what I'm interested in is how that manifested to you as a 4 or 5 year old girl. I mean, I know you went to New York, and well, we can talk about that as well.
Yeah, I have very little memory, as I say, of those years. Actually, really, before Dad died, I have very little memory of them. But I know that Mum had a breakdown after I was born and went into hospital. And I'm pretty sure she had a breakdown after my sister was born and went into hospital. I think my mum found it very difficult with my dad, with the heroin, and found it all very frightening. And it was frightening, the kind of people we were involved with and so on. And I think she also had a very traumatic childhood, which was marked by a lot of snobbery, which has made me rather anti-snobbery, because her parents were very rich lace and coal people. But of course, what they really wanted was class. And I think that snobbery was probably very damaging to their children in an insidious kind of way.
That, and things were quite different in those, you're talking about the 1950s and 60s.
Very, very, in the 40s, yeah, very, very different. Thank goodness things have changed now, you know, but their main focus in life, that family, would have been around trying to sort of move up a class. And I think that affected Mum a lot. And I think being with Dad was very difficult for her too, even though she was really in love with him. But I mean, she clearly had some kind of mental health disorder, which was diagnosed variously. My sister and I think it was bipolar in the end, exacerbated by very, very heavy alcoholism.
Right. What were the attempts at the diagnosis before? I mean,
she was diagnosed with schizophrenia. She was in and out of big, you know, the big old fashioned mental health hospitals and then the so-called nursing homes when she was a little bit less ill.
Yeah.
But schizophrenia was the main one, really. But I mean, clearly she didn't actually have schizophrenia, but she may now have been diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder. But I think it was more bipolar and very heavily influenced by this long, long history of very heavy drinking.
Yes. Can I interrupt and just say, can we get back to you? I know you're saying you don't have very much memory of it, but, you know, it struck me that it was a household which had a lot of nannies in it and people working for you, working for your parents. And, you know, I'm not saying your parents weren't loving, but maybe they were busy and it was a tricky time. And that you think you talked, I seem to find out that there were two people. It was a nanny called Joan and there was a gardener called Mr. Rich who were the favourites.
Oh, Mr. Rich in particular was wonderful and a very steady character in our lives. And it was sad when Dad died and he was no longer with us. He was very, very solid. And I think maybe my sister and I kind of probably lost ourselves in books and things and sort of clinging to each other, really. And I remember a lot of fear because quite a lot of the time the police would come round, which almost seems unbelievable. I know people think, oh God, this can't be true because they, you know, were so glamorous with the big house and everything. But the police used to come round to either try and arrest Dad or find out the kind of people he was dealing with. And also to see if about taking us away. And I can very clearly remember being very aware that you must tell the police that everything is all right at home, otherwise you'll be taken away. And
it was a huge fear for a child.
Yeah, because you want to stay at home and look after your parents. That's why. So I always used to say everything's fine sort of thing. And I'm sure Sarah,
yes,
my sister, did too.
But when did your asthma start?
Well, that started when I, for some strange reason, my parents went on a cruise and they stopped off in Jamaica. And I've no idea exactly what happened, but I assume Mum had what in those days they used to call a breakdown. And I've no idea what Dad was doing, but I went to live with some people they'd met on the cruise in Jamaica. I went and lived with these people in New York for 6 months.
How old were you?
I think I was about six or seven. And I can't remember much about it, except I can remember clawing it. They lived in a high-rise flat and they had sort of wire mesh on the windows, which I think was safety kind of thing. And I can remember Coca-Cola. And I can remember going to school there and the sort of moreness of America. And I can remember coming back and having an American accent. But
you don't feel that affected you, you know, psychologically?
Yes, I do, because I think that's what triggered my asthma.
Right.
I didn't have asthma until I got back from there. I mean, I think asthma is something like a number of diseases that's within you anyway, and then it's triggered by something. So yeah, I got that after that, yes.
And that stayed with you all your life, actually.
It has stayed with me all my life, and it's really pretty maddening now because I've got sort of extensive lung damage. So it's really boring because there's so much I want to do, and it's rather sort of crippling because you get so tired and because there's such a small amount of lung and everything. But But yeah, no, that's...
Yeah, that's bloody annoying.
Yeah.
We're annoyed about that for you.
Yeah, I am a bit annoyed,
So, when your sister Sarah arrived, do you remember, were you one of those kids who were going, oh my God, I'm not another sister? Or were you going, oh my God, fantastic?
Well, again, I can't really remember, but I would imagine I would think, oh my gosh, fantastic. And, you know, and as I say, I've always been very close to her and sort of wanted to look after her and so on.
Yeah.
So, no, I don't remember being jealous or anything. She kind of remembers me as being as being very, very bossy, I think, which I think I probably was. I think I was so wanting her to sort of survive everything that I was trying to sort of toughen her up all the time.
Yes. Things became quite tricky between your mother and father around the sort of 66, 67 point, with his heroin addiction going on. I know there was a bad car crash which he was driving, somebody was killed at the Moore prison, and it was all getting very, very fraught. And your mother decided to leave him.
Yes, she did leave him, and it was all pretty heavy duty at home and everything, and she left him, and we went and lived in a cottage in Bryn Sincin in Wales.
In Anglesey.
Yeah, Anglesey, yeah. Very small cottage. I think it was on the High Street opposite the pub. And
you had no money?
No money at all, no. I mean, we must have had some money, otherwise we would have died. But we had, you know, very, very little money. I can remember the total difference in the Christmas that we had there as opposed to at home, because obviously Dad wanted Mum back and wasn't going to send out lots of money. And
yes,
and she made friends with all, she was very, very eccentric Mum, and made friends with all the local boys, and you know, and actually started having an affair with one of them, who was a very young boy, although he seemed much older.
And 14, 15.
Yeah, 14, and in fact ended up being arrested for that and prosecuted, but actually went to a mental hospital instead of prison about it.
Yes. I mean, that is a massive thing, and I think the following years were very, very serious for you. And it's not to try and turn this into a drama. This is what this podcast is about. It's about mental health. I can imagine, I can quite see how that could have all happened between your mother and this you know, very young, nice boy or whatever. But of course it was a serious thing. But the consequences on you and Sarah, your sister, must have been, you know, I don't believe they'd just be, oh, hey ho, that happened.
No, it definitely wasn't. But I suppose I've got a weird thing of, I know lots of people have had trauma in their life, but I remember Mum, when she used to go to hospital, because there was so much going on with Dad's drugs and then the stuff in Wales and everything, that sometimes in the group therapy, she said they used to say, oh, Cherry's making up stories again, when actually it was true. And so I suppose I've got this strange thing myself where so many things happen that they almost seem like a story. And you know, and the Wales seems like a story, but it was hugely traumatic. But also when you're young, you're much more accepting of things, but you do look for ways to feel safe. Everything was very, very unsafe all the time.
Yes.
Extremely unsafe. And the boys themselves were wonderful, but it was kind of freaky having all these little boys running around all the time at home. And
They were like 12, 13, 14.
Well, anything from six upwards, you know, loads and loads of little boys hanging around my mum.
And Cherry, your mother, was like a sort of Pied Piper. I mean, I don't mean that it's salaciously. I just mean you know, she wanted a laugh and they wanted to be with her because she was so, you know, gorgeous or funny or whatever.
Yes, and they were all very poor and she had a tiny bit more money than them. But also she was a great sort of romantic. She sort of over-romanticized things. So she would, you know, think this was so romantic. I'm saving these boys. It's like whistle down the wind kind of thing.
Yes, yes.
But in fact, it all backfired horrendously on her because, because of the... and on the boy, of course, of the affair that she had.
Do you know what happened to him?
No, and I'm always trying to find him. I really want to find him because I saw him a few years later after Dad died. He came and saw Mum. I'd love to know what happened to him, but his name was... I'm not sure whether I'm allowed to say his name, actually. I better not. But his name was so common.
Say his first name.
Robert. But he was very a wonderful person. I'd love to find him again and see what happened to him because he will have had the most extraordinary experience because he was living in total poverty in Wales. And then his life ended up really basically being controlled by my dad and the police. And he probably went back there and I don't know what happened, but.
Well, I'm sure the terrible thing in these situations is that if you don't feel a sense of shame when you start, by the time other people have got round you, they instill a load of shame. And I wonder what happened to you. I mean, I know you've always had to cope and sort of navigate the storm, and so you bat away a lot of stuff, but you know, we all want to belong. We all want to be part of the gang, don't we? I mean, especially as 10, 12-year-old kids. Mm. I mean, what did you feel?
Well, funnily enough, that feeling of not fitting in, I mean, my sister might say something different, was not my major concern. My major concern was fear, you know, and lack of safety.
Yeah.
And also I think in a way we didn't have to face the not fitting in because we weren't part of a big social set because my mum and dad didn't see lots of friends or be part of a sort of drinks party set or anything like that. So when we were younger, we weren't really in a group of friends except at school in which you could be the odd one out.
Yes.
Because they were so unsociable, except if they went to London. And I suppose at school, perhaps I did the opposite, both Sarah and I, because we became punks, Sarah more so than me. But I never felt ashamed of Mum. Well, actually, no, that's not fair. I did, because she used to have a horrendous hairstyle, a sort of kind of beehive-type hairstyle, and I remember that was really, really embarrassing.
Right.
I don't know. The fitting in thing is a funny thing. Because of that, there wasn't anyone to fit in with. And at school, perhaps I became rather sort of bossy as a way of not fitting in, if you see what I mean.
Yes.
I'll be the leader, thank you very much, sort of thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm in charge. But, and again, I'm not looking for trouble by saying this. I'm just stating it, that, you know, sadly your father died in 1969, I think. And you weren't, I think you weren't ever clear on the circumstances of that.
No, it was an open verdict, whether it was accidental or suicide or whether some people say that sometimes dealers give you a strong dose if you're kind of talking too much or causing too much trouble. So don't know what happened. He was found in a copse on the estate, dead. So,
right.
Yeah, that was very...
With an overdose of heroin.
With an overdose of heroin, yeah.
Right.
Very, very unexpected. So that was really, really, really sad. And I'm aware that I'm probably making it sound like a story, but But as you probably know, you've kind of worked so hard over the years to try and survive that it kind of does become a story, if you know what I mean. And
I completely understand that. And I think it's, you know, as I say, it's very easy to just make it bullet points. So, well, that, you know, but it's important that people understand that none of these things are black and white, but a lot of them are to do with basic stuff. I mean, like, I think it's true to say your dad died and then it took 2 years plus for probate to be granted.
Yeah.
Meaning there was no money at all.
No,
correct?
No, there wasn't. And again, you know, again, we must have had some or we would have starved, but it was a total, total change in circumstances. And of course, Mum went straight into a mental hospital sort of the moment he died. And so we were kind of in the care.
Because she was still in love with him.
She was in love with him all the time, yes, and also she was mentally ill as well. But, you know, we were in the care of other people and so on, and different things like that. I would say one of the things you were talking about, the shame and everything, I don't think I have the shame, but I do have and still have and can't get rid of it sometimes, feelings of total abject fear because of the unsafety. And I think what was so bad for us is that we were unprotected children, and people know that and can feel that, and all sorts of things happen, both big and little, to children who are viewed as vulnerable.
Yes.
I think kind of trying to stay safe from that or avoid that as much as possible is the thing that's traumatized me the most, is being too vulnerable children.
Yes.
If you see what I mean. And sort of learning to cope with that. And that fear of vulnerability has stayed with me.
Yes, yes, I understand that. And well, also you said some time ago to me that, you know, the estate was confiscated or land agents came and took everything. And you know, including your dolls' houses and things like that. But there was no one there to stick up for you, to stand up for you.
No. So, you know, the whole estate kind of went, and we were really too young, much too young to be able to sort of do anything about it all, you know. And I expect there was death duties and things like that, but you know, life totally changed after that, basically, because there was no adult to look after my dad's what you call affairs now, and Mum was never in any fit state to do anything like that.
Yes.
And so I think, you know, without being slanderous, I think that some people, you know, made quite a bit of money.
Oh, really?
And, but, well, you know, sort of indirectly, you know, perhaps by selling things to people they knew and so on, but.
Right.
Not necessarily right. Totally dishonestly or anything, but, you know, you can imagine if a whole estate became free and there was no actual interested party dealing with it, it would be.
Things could have, yes, I see what you mean.
Things could have happened, yeah.
Right, okay. How big an estate was it? I mean, just so people can understand that. I mean, is it, I don't know, 100 acres or what?
I mean, well, I remember going up with my granddaughter, you know, a few years ago, and the old estate agent who's now died said, oh, as far as the land can see, it was, you know, at least 20,000 acres. We had, you know, we had a lodge at the end of every drive, so there was a five lodges, and then we had loads and loads of farms, and it was a totally different life to the life I live now. Totally different, yeah.
Yes.
We had, I don't know, you know, gave a bonfire party for the village, and, you know, it was sort
yeah,
of like
I understand.
That. Yeah.
So massive change.
Massive, massive change. And I think that was, it was a bit of a cushion, even though things were very difficult, even that, you know, before that all went.
Yes, yes, of course. And then I can understand, you know, that fundamental fear of not being safe. I think I can see that as huge, you know. Very, very tricky. So you were in the boarding school, and then presumably you were not in boarding school. I don't know whether whatever happened, but I think you went to Nottingham and then to London.
Yeah, went to Nottingham and then managed to sort of get out of the convent where I was at to go.
What was that like?
The convent was. It was sort of okay. The nicest school was Whitford Hall, which was the school I went to before, where there was the most fantastic headmistress called Mary Booker.
Oh, right.
And advice to any of your listeners, if you have a teacher who sort of pretty well changed your life, write to her now, or him now.
Yes.
Because I went to write to her and I found out she died, but she was absolutely wonderful and introduced me to the escape and joy of reading. But
yes, I think that's a really great thing to say, actually. Very, very, very important.
If anybody's really, really made your life a lot better, including teachers, write to them now.
Yeah, yeah.
But I just realised I had to get out of boarding school because I had to look after Mum and everything. And so Sarah and I think Sarah left as well, I'm not sure. And we went to school in Nottinghamshire near Southall and then lived with Mum, and things were very different indeed. We lived in a little house on the high street.
Right. And how was her health then? How did it all manifest? Because it presumably wasn't always all bad, but, you know, what was the story?
Well, she was lovely and wonderful and tried to make everything beautiful when she was okay, but the gaps when she was not okay were quite small. And I remember her going to a mental hospital in Saxondale in Nottingham and thinking she's never going to come back from this. She would be very, very mad. Southall, for example, she held a gun to my head. She tried to set fire to the house. She put tomatoes and candlesticks all around the house outside of it. She would just be utterly mad. Even later on, when she lived near me in Lechlade, she bought everything from, I don't know how she did it, out of all the shops. And
yes.
Then with my sister, she used to go mad accusing us of sleeping with her boyfriends, who were, well, her boyfriends were pretty awful, no disrespect to them, but they were. I think my sister had a very bad time when she was alone with her. She would just be drunk, and she would completely change character when she was drunk. I can remember she used to be on the phone to me saying, you might have to cut this, you f-ing little jumped up county slag and everything like that, and f-ing and all that sort of thing. And then the next moment it would be, you're the most wonderful thing. You're the most wonderful thing in the world. In fact, my parents used to call me Karen O'Brien, as brave as a lion. And I always held on to that. But Mum used to completely change character when she was drunk. And that was very, very difficult for us. And I think it was even more difficult for my sister because she was much, much younger. She became very sort of aggressive and horrible.
Very difficult to take.
Yeah.
But your conclusion, I mean, clearly, you know, alcoholic and seriously alcoholic, but your conclusion about the bipolar manic depressive thing, I mean, have you sort of run that through your criteria and gone, yup, that's ticked all those boxes? I mean, did she get very manic?
Oh yes, like as I say, that the buying all the things in the shops, you know, I kind of still feel so angry with the shops because I tried to take the stuff back and you know, only a few of them would take it back. And I feel there should be laws about that. Yes, I think so. And also I found lithium in amongst her stuff when she died. She often had Largactil. She used to eat handfuls of what was then called Mogadon, handfuls of diazepam. She was sort of a mess, really.
Yes.
So it may well be schizoaffective disorder, a mixture of both, with perhaps what would now be called a personality disorder, which I suppose is some people would think is a kind of definition of how your personality is affected by the difficult events in your childhood.
Right. So, I mean, that went on, didn't it? I mean, and you...
That went on.
I mean, it's incredible to support that. I mean, very amazing.
Well, it was terrifying, as I'm sure you know. I found it, again, that's another thing of sort of abject fear in a way, but terrifying about what she would do when she was drunk. You know, she lost her license. She didn't actually end up in prison, which was, you know, it was the fear of what she would do or whether she would die and the kind of men she would pick up. And
yes,
I was just terrified of what would happen to her.
No, I can, that she would be driving a car and, you know, smash into a restaurant or something. Yeah.
Yeah. Or someone would kill her because she was being so sort of awful, or, you know.
But you didn't have any, I mean, you know, here you were probably in this point, you're probably 16. I guess something like that in the Nottingham days. So it's quite very hard for you to really be, I mean, you know, you couldn't sort of say, well, look, if you don't take your medication, I'm getting you sectioned. You couldn't do any of that.
Well, that was the thing. She always thought that I did section her, and all the time, and saying, you know, you bloody person, you got me in here, you know, and things like that. But, I suppose I did have some sort of control. But yes, she always thought it was all my fault that she was in hospital, always.
Gosh, very tough for you, that.
Well, it was, everything was sort of my fault, and that her whole madness was kind of aimed at me and at Sarah when it was just Sarah with her.
But there was no one else on hand, I mean...
No.
To help you.
Well, it's so funny you should say that, but no, and I've never thought of that, Jeremy. That's really odd. There wasn't anyone who could help us with Mum, no.
I mean, you know, we've only, you know, the funny part of this story, and it is a story, but it doesn't matter, you know, is that we are only at 16 with you. And it feels like, you know, you've put up with an incredible amount. And I mean, what is weird is that, you know, there's a saying that I know, which is that if A helps B, A gets better. You know, in other words, if you help somebody else, it keeps you together. That's a very sort of silly little homily, but it's true. And you know, throughout your life, you've looked after, particularly Cherry, your mother, and I think you've done an awful lot for someone you love very much, Sarah, your sister. And I think it's you know, the irony of that is that if you didn't have those two people in your life, you know, maybe it wouldn't have been so great. You know, maybe you would have been overwhelmed by a lot of these circumstances. Don't know. What do you think?
I think that I think it was a great sort of privilege in a way for me to be able to sort of look after my sister.
Yeah.
And I think perhaps that did help me survive. I sometimes think that it's more difficult for the not looked after one, because I had a kind of focus because she was...
Yeah.
Younger, and I was, and because she was younger, I was also focused on my mum, so I was just focused on them.
You were empowered to do those.
I was focused on them both surviving, kind of thing. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
Yes.
And I mean, basically, we come all the way round now up to you leaving Nottingham and going to Oxford, retaking your A levels, doing all that, and then getting to Canterbury, where you met this chap, Simon, I think.
Yeah.
And that must have been really great, because here's the band, I'm part of it. Brilliant.
Yeah, that was all quite snazzy. Yeah, the only bad thing about it, of course, was that for most of the time, my sister was then alone with Mum, which was pretty bad for her.
Yes.
Very bad. But we did go back quite a bit. But yeah, it was really, really good fun with the with the band. I have had lots of fun in my life. Yeah.
And you were thinking about getting married at that point.
Yeah, I was thinking of getting married. I was really, really in love with this guy, if he ever listens. He might do because he's on Instagram. I was really, really in love with him. But from what I remember is that the manager said, whether this was true or not.
Manager of the group.
The manager of the group said, oh, you can't get married because, you know, it's not good for the image because you're going to be so big. And so the marriage stopped and I had to take my wedding dress back and all that sort of thing.
Oh, gosh.
And I think one of the strange things about that is that I remember thinking, you know, not long after that, it sort of ended the relationship. And I remember thinking, you know, there is no point in being alive if I can't be with Simon. There is absolutely no point. And I think that taught me a huge lesson because I really thought that. And actually, there was a point in being alive, you know, that, you know, but yeah.
No, but it's a big thing. And for you to have said that was quite something, actually. It must have meant an awful lot. And it's great that you came through that and then went to London, had lots of fun. And then you, well, I mean, I'm just thinking all the time, you met Paul.
Yeah.
And thought, hello.
Yeah, I did. That was all... very good, yes. He was extremely nice. I kind of fell into him and, you know, I started sort of asking his advice about absolutely everything. I can remember even ringing him up and saying, if you have a cold, which do you think is better, handkerchiefs or tissues? And sort of just really, really liking being with somebody who kind of knew things. And he sort of taught me all sorts of things, like how to order in an Indian restaurant, you know, millions of things. And he was just very nice.
And he was safe.
He was very, very safe. And he really liked me.
Which is extremely handy.
Very handy, yes.
No, I mean, I can see it. You can see it. It's like, hallelujah.
Yeah.
This is a brilliant result. And yeah. I think that's absolutely fantastic. So basically, you got married, which is great. And then, you know, unbelievably, Lara, Nina, Molly, Johnny appeared just like that.
Which was absolutely wonderful and so lucky.
And you even had Barney, the three-legged dog, and Megan, the very, very bonkers cat. But I think the children must be absolutely tremendous for you, and you've got your... You know, you are the queen of the castle with your knight in shining armor to look after you. And the sad part is that I think your mum had moved up to be near you. What was that like? I mean, you know, challenging and...
It was challenging. Actually, it just made me think of something. It made me think of something about the unseen and so on, and about how, for example, round here... And I always remember it about my father as well, that, and about everything, in fact, about the unseen, about how people say, oh, your mother was absolutely marvellous, because they loved, and this makes me angry, and it's something that I have tried to come to terms in. Your mum was absolutely marvellous. She was so eccentric. Oh, God, she used to hide her bottle here. But how people sanitize that and don't see the reality, and that I think it's so important that you know the reality, or that people used to think your dad's so glamorous, you know, and the idea of the Kurt Cobain type character shooting up, and that you know, you must not try and sanitize other people's experience, because there's a big downside to those things, you know.
Well, I think we've all learnt a lot, haven't we? You know, because I can certainly remember, and it still goes on, actually, people saying you should never trust a man who doesn't drink.
Oh, God, yes.
You know, I know what I'm talking about, you know, and all that crap. And I understand, you know, I think it's that people want to be, it's that the people who can't be something often big up the other person who's a bit, you know, mad, or, you know, massive drunk or junkie or something. You know, what's wrong with that? You know, leave him alone. And yeah, I get that.
And I also think it, I also think separately, another thing is, one is they glamorize that and think it's wonderful to be free because they could feel they can never be free in any way themselves. But also, I think there's a great tendency for people to want to minimize other people's negative experience. And I don't think that's a good thing.
But why do you think that? Why do they want to minimize? You mean in the same way I just said?
Because I think if someone else has survived a worse, a more difficult experience than you have had,
yes,
I think it can make you feel lesser. And so then you attempt to downgrade their experience.
Right.
So it wasn't that bad. You know, I think strangely enough, very negative experience can make the person who's hearing about it feel lesser, just as a very positive experience could make the other person feel lesser.
Yes, yes. Let's just talk about your mum. I mean, it struck me, and I don't know why this is, but that medication never worked for her, and things like AA never worked for her. Why, you know, I'm not being simple, but why is that, do you think?
I just don't know. And, you know, Jeremy, I was thinking the other day that she died really just around the time that community mental health teams were coming in. And I think, if I'm getting the timings right, and I think that when she was ill, it was just, you know, the GP or go into hospital. And I think Mum would really would have benefited from the steady input of a community mental health team. But to be honest, I think it was alcohol that stopped everything working.
Yeah.
I think alcohol was horrendous, absolutely horrendous. She had fits and all sorts. It was what killed her in the end.
Yes, but you don't think it was possible for her to have stopped?
She did used to sometimes stop drinking, and that was wonderful. But I mean, obviously, it probably would have been possible. And in hindsight, maybe. I don't know why she never really. She was just too sad. That's the thing. She was just too sad.
Really, even then?
I think after my father died, and also, you know, she had a very bad experience, at least one incredibly bad experience when she was young, and I just don't really think she could cope with life. And I don't know what would have made her better, and I think that's quite interesting in itself. You know, maybe... You know, maybe I was too enthralled with her. Maybe I would have sort of, if I was to be with her now, I might have thought of other things. I don't know.
But you don't think that she could have helped herself in the end?
I don't know. She did sometimes give up drinking, but I think she was just too sad. What was the point, sort of thing?
Yes. And also she didn't, you know, maybe she just didn't care anymore anyway, that it was like, so what, you know? And people do get to that extent, and that they, and I, you know, reintroduce the AA into this, that, you know, they go to AA and they just see they don't get it, because it's like, oh, everyone's so chirpy, you know, what is the point, you know? It just seems a sad, you know, it was a sad end, but, you know, there we go, she died.
It was kind of also, it was a way of life for her, drinking. It was a total way of life, you know. She said that when she was young, you know, drinking in her household was a way of life, and that there was an air of tension before 6 o'clock in the evening. Everything was about alcohol.
Yes.
So she was brought up with alcohol, and
well, I understand that. I understand that you can have a culture of drinking.
A total culture of drinking. Everything was waiting to drink.
Mm. That sort of with nail and eye department.
Yes, sort of thing. And you know, but as a child as well, you know, sort of her mum was a big drinker. Everyone was, yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sadly, she died in 1992, I think.
Yes, early 1992, yeah.
And the extraordinary coincidence, it seems to me, he said with a smile on his face, is that that's the same year you chose to train as a psychologist.
I know. Well, she left me some money, and so it meant I could do the training. I had to take the A levels and all that sort of thing and take a degree and things. And so I really wanted to do that. And I also wanted to do something I believe in. I suppose looking back, you know, instead of just sort of believing in Mum, which is a bit of a silly thing just to believe in one person, you know, believe in trying to get Mum better and Sarah. But, you know, something to believe in and that sort of thing.
And something for you. I mean, surely that this was that you were going to do this and it wasn't you were doing it for you.
Perhaps, yes. Yeah.
Well, speaking as a doctor, I think that's true. And I think that's great that you did it because presumably, did that have some, you know, some really good consequences in the sense that I know if you train to do something like this, it is pretty demanding. And I know one of the things that they do is they say you have to have therapy yourself.
Yes. Well, funnily enough, in actual training as a psychologist, as a psychotherapist, you have to do that. But as a psychologist, you don't have to, although I think we did have to have 6 weeks of it. And that was very useful. Yes, it's all been very useful. And I've absolutely loved all my clients. And, you know, it's been great. You know, funnily enough, my sister's also gone into mental health now.
Yes. Again, no coincidence.
No.
There, as no. they say.
In exactly the same mental health team as me in this area. So, you know.
Okay, I'm not going to switch off from that. I just want to ask you a diversionary question. Have you ever had any faith? As in, have you ever been attracted to a religion, to a higher power, to anything like that?
Well, that's such a funny thing, isn't it? Because I've been thinking about this. I always sort of wanted to convert to Roman Catholicism, although I never quite knew why, but I haven't done that, and it's only really a sort of pie-in-the-sky thing. No, I don't have a particular higher thing, but I do believe that the whole point of life is to be good and, you know, a good person, and whether that's faith or not, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, and to be a useful person, maybe. Yeah, yes. I'm interested about the Roman Catholic thing because, you know, that's quite a well-trodden path in the sense of converts, you know, Evelyn Waugh, Graham Greene, and on and on and on it goes. I'll tell you a funny thing, which, because I know that you are related to the Birkin family, Jane Birkin and co., John Barry, who was married to Jane Birkin, in the last few years of his life, used to go to Mass every single day.
Gosh, well.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Yes, well, my granny, who was a Birkin, actually converted to Catholicism.
Ah.
And the family all used to joke that it was because she'd done so many bad things and she wanted to be on God's on God's side. So, you know, that's interesting, yes. And then maybe that put it into my head. And I've just watched this wonderful programme on BBC One, the one about the monks, but also the Being series about various religions, and
yes.
I have been thinking about faith of different types.
I think that's very interesting, and we will talk more about that. What I think we're going to do now is it's the Easter edition, is we're going to have a pause, and then we're going to come back and finish off talking about you and what happened once we got past 2000, really. And and then we're going to get on and talk about the muchly interesting things, which is the life jackets and all the tunes and the books and all that. So this is a bumper edition, but I think we should have a break, and I think we'll continue later on. So, yeah, here we are. We're back in the programme and we're coming to the end of the actual meat and potatoes part. And, you know, really, Karen, it's now to look backwards, I suppose, that having done nearly 20 years, well, you've done over that now, I know, but you got through the whole thing of the, being a psychologist all that time. I mean, what have you learned? Is there something that you learned, and was there something that resolved for you by being a psychologist all this time?
I don't know whether being a psychologist resolved anything for me. I think learning to be a psychologist, I learned lots and lots of useful techniques and ways of being. I think perhaps one of the most important things is learning to be honest with yourself. Mm. And that includes allowing yourself to feel emotion without it tipping over into something else.
Yes.
So allowing yourself to experience things and feel things and not being afraid of that. I think that's one big thing, learning to recognize and cope with emotions without being scared stiff of them.
I think that's very interesting for other people to hear that, because a lot of people almost feel they're, you know, they've got a cliff either side of them, and that if they go into some sort of emotion like anger, real anger, they will fall off into the, you know, off the cliff, as it were.
I know. I actually remember a lot of clients or patients, whatever you like to call them nowadays, saying that they didn't want to talk about certain things because they thought they would never stop crying. Mm. And I used to say, I can assure you, I've never had anyone who's never stopped crying. And I think another thing I learned, perhaps related back to myself, I don't know, is that a lot of people are very, very afraid of being disloyal about their parents.
Yes.
And that actually holds them back terribly in life, because they're holding on to this picture of their parents and they somehow think that that is what's making them feel all right. When in fact, kind of admitting and accepting and feeling and taking on board the foibles and mistakes your parents made isn't disloyalty, but you can still carry on loving them and accept them for what they are and why they did it. But it holds you back very much, this idea of extreme loyalty, even within the therapy setting.
I get that. Yeah, very interesting. And I mean, if I ask you, you know, whether you think you've held back about your parents, what would you say?
I don't know, but I think that, I don't think I have held back about my parents, but I would think that some people may think that, because for some reason I don't hate them, you know, I don't.
Yes.
I don't hate them, and I don't know why, or I'm not angry with them.
Is that because you use this as a sort of cliche that they did the best they could under the circs?
I think they probably did do the best they could, which wasn't great. I think if I were to have any anger, it would be, and what touched me when you spoke and I felt sort of a bit on edge, was there not being other people around to help.
Mm, sure. Yeah.
Either for them or for us somehow.
Yes.
And I think perhaps that's affected me. And I very much don't want to ever not be around for people, you know.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of okay in a way, where you're going, well, I don't like Mr. and Mrs. Smith, or they done me wrong anyway, so I'm not going to go to their aid. But not when they have two small children. That's a slightly different ball game for me.
Yes. Yes.
But there we go. Okay, so we've got, we're sort of coming to the end, and of course, you know, the last 10 years of your life, or perhaps not that long, but was filled with a lot more sadness with Paul, your husband, father of your wonderful children, who sadly became
pretty ill. Children.
Yeah. Who sadly became very ill. And that was obviously quite a serious tall order for you to deal with. I don't know what you can say.
Well, he got diagnosed with dementia in 2010, which was a strange, unusual form of dementia called primary progressive aphasia. And I think for your listeners, this might be worth thinking about. I think he was actually getting ill for years before that. And I think that's one of the things about dementia is I think it's really worth kind of trying to keep an eye on your partner's or loved one's behaviours, because one tends to just dismiss changes, and maybe it's worth noticing them because of the kind of decisions they might make. But he was diagnosed with that, and he was very, very sad about it. And we looked after him, and then he died in 2016. But we were amazingly lucky, or rather I was, and he wasn't, because primary progressive aphasia is one of those dementias where you know exactly what's going on, except at the very end, which actually the very end of the dementia didn't come for Paul. And it's easier for the carer to look after you. Yeah. Whereas in something like Alzheimer's, you don't know what's going on, and you know your behaviours can be incredibly strange. Not that some of Paul's weren't, and it's much more difficult for the carer. So It was terrible for Paul, but not so terrible for us, really, although it wasn't great, kind of thing. And he had a lucky release because he died of heart failure.
Yes, but I think, you know, in terms of you, if I can say this, that, you know, I think Paul was such a constant, steady and really loving person that, apart from his temper, whatever you said it, you know, mentioned.
Yes.
You know, I think he was a great, as you say, a great saviour for you.
Yes, he was very, very much so. And besides anything else, I think one's very, very lucky if in your life you've had someone who loves you so much.
Yeah.
And I think perhaps, I'm sure my parents did love me, and I'm sure they love my sister, but I think it was rather marvellous to experience that. You know, even though partner's love isn't necessarily unconditional, it felt unconditional, very unconditional love. So it was very healing, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one last thing before we go into the wonderfully exciting world of the life jackets. You're obviously very, very close to your sister, Sarah. If you had to sum it up, what does she represent for you?
Oh, she's done an awful lot for me. I mean, I don't know whether she did it on purpose, sounds strange, but she visited me all the time when Paul was ill. And, you know, she lives very near me now. And I suppose what Sarah has done for me is not something that she's done on purpose, is really what really saved me is looking after her. Not that I probably did a very, very good job, you know, because I'm really only a child, but I think her very existence, if she hadn't existed, I think things might have been
very different,
quite different for me.
And it's also, I think you said once that, you know, it makes a hell of a difference if you've got somebody who's come from the place that's pretty crazy that you've come from.
Yes, I know. We're both now in this area, and I suppose in some ways it's quite a sort of comfort. Yeah, it is a comfort that someone who comes from where you come from, and there's a safety in it, and
yeah, I mean, definitely,
yeah, great love still, and but of course Sarah's, you know, sort of grown up now, and
And I'm very pleased that she's, you know, begun to have the life she wanted to, because she had a number of other great sadnesses in her life.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well.
But she's having a good time now, I think.
Well, that is great. You're both, you know, you're both survivors. Incredible. And absolutely incredible. So now what we are going to do is we are now going to move to the life jackets part, Corinne, which is very, very exciting. So these are the things that you're going to go to when you just need to feel good. And you talked about film, and you talked about Paris, Texas, and that was your and Paul's favourite film.
Yes, that was very much kind of our film. And I laugh because I always remember taking a really close friend from round here to it and her thinking or showing it out, thinking it was so boring because it's a very slow moving film. But it's about love, and it's rather wonderful. So I might watch that and yes. Escape into that. Yes.
Well, I think that's rather great. And now going on to books. You talk about Shuggy Bain, Douglas Stewart, which I think is, I've given more copies of that book than I think anything else recently.
I just thought it was an absolute masterpiece, and I was so happy because I think I was one of the first people to read it, and I said, this is wonderful, to Douglas Stewart, and I got a reply back, thank goodness. But I just thought the portrayal, and even my sister said it, who doesn't have such good memories of not that there were particularly many good memories of my mum, just said that the portrayal of being the child of an alcoholic is sort of universal and so powerful. It's just the most wonderful, wonderful book, and it deserves everything it gets.
Yeah, well, that's brill. That's really good. And you mentioned a book I didn't know, Gabrielle Krause.
That's another absolutely tremendous book about a guy.
Who they was.
Who is a Polish guy who is on the street in gangs in London, but he also does an English degree at the same time.
Oh, right.
But he's at pains to say in his interviews that he isn't two people, he's both people. And I think that's one of the most important things to think about, is that you can be everything. Mm. You know, in his case, he's a gang member and a top-class English literature student, but they're both the same person. And I think sometimes one of the things that makes people feel so awful is they can't marry the two sides of themselves. You can think bad things and you can be very good. You know, I think marrying very opposite, like I can be very wild and I also can be very cozy.
Yeah, yeah.
Doesn't mean you've got a split or anything. You can be everything.
Yes, interesting. Well, I certainly don't. I'm somebody who does not think it's all black and white. I think that's just nonsense. So, yeah, like it. Now, this is. I'm going to see if this works. Here we are.
Lord, I was born a rambling man. I love that. Yeah, love that.
I thought you might.
Well, that takes me back to feeling sort of momentarily really, really free with this wonderful boyfriend, even though I was taking amphetamines all the time when I was younger. And
this is
it was just wonderful, yeah.
The Canterbury.
No, it was before that. Oh, it was a different one, yeah.
Oh, right, okay.
Even before that, yeah.
Gosh, right. Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, but that is one, and so that's sort of like, that's your nostalgia one, okay? And I like this one that you've also said, okay?
Yeah. I'm in the phone booth, it's the one across the hall. If you don't answer, I'll just ring it on the wall. I know who's there, but I just try to call.
Love that.
Well,
Blondie.
Well, that was Blondie was Paul's favourite, and I absolutely loved her, so that was amazing.
I think what was good about Blondie was that they wrote they wrote, you know, really good pop songs within a sort of rock and roll setting, and that she was sexy and, you know, great and everything. And but they were quite short, their songs, you know. I mean, we liked them, didn't we?
Yes, absolutely loved them, yes. Really, really loved them.
And you also suggested or selected on your takeaway jukebox Shout by Lulu. And I would definitely associate that song with you.
Well, I used to, and I still love sort of wild parties and being crazy and everything, as well as being cozy. And I'd like that at my funeral, actually. Shout. I love Shout. a bit old to be wild and crazy now, but I used to love it.
That's great. Okay. I think that's really, I think that's really good.
You know, all the time, Jeremy, that you're talking, one of the things I wanted to say about a life jacket,
yes,
is I've been lucky enough to have four absolutely amazing children who have the wonderful traits of my mother and father, not so much the bad ones, and of Paul and my grandchildren, and they are a huge life jacket. They're so real and honest and wonderful. I'm so lucky.
Yes. Well, I can understand that. I've met them once or twice, and I think they're quite quite nice sometimes. No.
They are very nice, yeah.
But there's an interesting thing that you said. You had a garden as a child in part of our garden, so a little part for you, but nothing would grow, I think because it was dark.
Yes, but I didn't realise that nothing would grow in the dark, but I kept on doing it.
But that's quite interesting, isn't it? Sort of, you know what I mean? Things don't grow in the dark, and you have to, you know, you have to put them in the sunlight. And
yeah,
I mean, the metaphor of that is good, I think, you know.
Yes, you have to look at the sun, you know, because there's so many wonderful things in the world, you know.
But I think, and I'm sure you agree, that, you know, it's a mental health thing that, you know, if you remain, you know, if you're really dark in the head and you remain in the dark and you don't go into the light, you know, nothing will get better. You know, we have to try and, you know, stay in the light.
Oh, very much so. Stay in the light, stay in the beautiful. I hang on to, you know, how my mum used to try to make everything beautiful, and Paul taught me so much about the light because he loved the outdoors and trees and
yes,
birds and all sorts of things, you know. So
yes,
yeah, the light in small things. And actually I've got a really wonderful friend down here in Bampton who is, she would be surprised to hear this, but she's taught me a lot about the light, about just enjoying having a cup of tea in a nice cup and things yeah, like that, you know, that the smallness, it's the small things that can add up to make things happen.
I totally agree with that, and I think that's very powerful stuff, that, you know.
Yes.
When I lived in Greece, and I just say this very quickly, when I lived in Greece, you know, the greatest thing for me on this island, which was a very famous island, was getting a newspaper from England or magazine or something. And I used to sit and read it at a cafe with a cup of coffee and a cigarette. And that was the best moment of the week. It's small things.
And it's the ability to savour those moments, because each moment you have passes. And if you can make as many moments as possible like that moment with the paper, you're doing well.
Like it. Now, the extraordinary thing about you that I would never, ever have expected is your interest in trains.
And I know.
And I've got you a job on a TGV train, and you're going to be the assistant driver. But I think that's I think I love that. And I mean, do you like travelling on trains? You know, long journeys. And is it Agatha Christie?
I love trains. You know, one of my sort of dreams is to go on, you know, a really long train journey. And I used to go on a train journey up to North Berwick to see my step-grandmother, and she lived, her house was literally, you went down the steps and there of the train and there was her house. And I just absolutely love trains. I'm not an expert on them, but I love them.
Yes.
A bit nerdy, but I do.
No, and you could do you like crosswords.
I love crosswords.
So you could do a crossword on the train.
Yes, while eating what used to be called British Rail breakfast. Yeah.
Okay, all right. And I would suspect, I mean, you've chosen your children as a life belt, but I would suspect that friendships are very, very important to you.
Yes, friendships are enormously important to me, and I feel that although I've said my children are so great, which they are absolutely marvellous, and grandchildren, I do feel very pro the idea that a family is not, oh, it's just the family, or, oh, it's family only. A family is a base with which to go out and include others. So friendships are just as important to me as family. And I feel that that's something that perhaps other people should think about.
Yeah.
Actually, thinking about it, can I just add that our many cousins have been a great life belt for us as well?
Well, I think that's great. So we've got the life jackets. And obviously, continuing to be on Shed Talks is a huge life jacket. And you are, in fact...
Yes, it is a huge life. But then you're a huge life jacket.
Oh, that's nice. I'll keep the standing order going. Anyway, listen, it's been really fab. And the thing about you is that you're a very brave person.
Yeah. Oh, God. Well, weirdly enough, I told you my parents used to call me Karen O'Brien as brave as a little lion, and I've held on to that. But then I just feel so blooming lucky with the people who have been around me and really, really lucky, and things have sort of been okay. And as Paul used to say, you know, even when things are really bad, you're still alive and there are still little nice things like the nice cup.
Yes.
You know, often there's some little chink of light.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. This is about mental health, this show. But, you know, you're a great example of resilience and also somebody who has given a lot to others and doubtless still will. Rock on.
Well, it's been wonderful talking to you.
Thank you so much. We love you and thank you. And
well, I love you and you're fantastic. Okay. And thank you very much. Okay.
All right. FAB. We will speak very, very soon. Okay.
All right. Speak very soon.
Thank you to Stuart Bagshaw, our top engineer editor. Thank you to Bea Brooke, our top administrator, production manager. Thank you to Karen Cowan, our top guest. If you want to find out more about Shed Talks, visit our website, jeremythomastalks.co.uk. Please sign up to the newsletter. If you want to write to us or find out anything about anybody or contact anyone on the show, inquiries@jeremythomastalks.co.uk. inquiries@jeremythomastalks.co.uk. You can find us on Facebook at Shed Talks, Shed Talks Twitter at JT Shed Talks, Instagram-JeremyThomasTalks. We've had quite a lot of inquiries about what the theme tune is, and it's called The Beast, and it's written and performed by Milt Buckner. So it's all been tip-top and totally tidy. Stay safe, be groovy. Please sign up, support, and share this. Thanks a lot. Goodbye.